Bush went on speaking for a moment or two about how much he appreciated my service and how much he would miss me. His charm was on full display, but it was hard to know if it was sincere or just an attempt to make me feel better. But as he continued, something I had never seen before happened. Tears were streaming down both cheeks. I found myself in the funny position of consoling the president. "It's okay, sir," I said. "I'm ready to go. It's been a long ride." We visited a little while longer and had a warm embrace. As we were about to leave the office together, Bush turned to me. "I hear Jill is pretty upset," he said. "Yes, sir, she is. It's hard for her to understand, and it's not easy for me to explain to her since politics isn't her background." "She loves you very much," Bush said, "and her only concern is you. Should I call her?" I paused for a second. "I think she would appreciate that, and it might help a little. She has a lot of affection for you and Mrs. Bush." "I will call her," he said. I spoke to Jill later that afternoon. "Did the president call you?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "He and Josh both called me separately." "How was it?" I asked. "The president didn't have to do that," she said. "He was very nice and tried to help me understand. And Josh was fine." I could tell Jill was touched by the president taking the time to call. She didn't have a lot more to say about those two conversations. She was still pretty emotional about what was happening to me, and Josh Bolton, understandably, wasn't on her list of favorite people at the moment. That Wednesday, before a trip to Tuskegee, Alabama, the president and I walked out to Marine One together. But we had a stop to make first, a place on the South Lawn outside the Oval where the press had been alerted to wait for a statement. It was much the same as when the president had made the announcement nearly 3 years earlier that I would be replacing Ari Fleischer as press secretary. As we walked from the office to the waiting microphone, the president told me he would try to keep from choking up. The press knew, as soon as they saw us move in their direction, that I was a dead man walking. I spoke first. "Good morning, everybody. I'm here to announce that I will be resigning as White House press secretary. Mr. President," here I had to clear my throat ever so briefly as I momentarily choked up, "it has been an extraordinary honor and privilege to have served you for more than 7 years now, the last 2 years and 9 months as your press secretary. The White House is going through a period of transition. Change can be helpful, and this is a good time and good position to help bring about change. I am ready to move on. I've been in this position a long time, and my wife and I are excited about beginning the next chapter in our life together. You have accomplished a lot over the last several years with this team, and I've been honored and grateful to be a small part of a terrific and talented team of really good people. Our relationship began back in Texas, and I look forward to continuing it, particularly when we are both back in Texas." "That's right," the president said, provoking laughter, "although I hope to get there before you." Laughter. "I have given it my all, sir, and I've given you my all, and I will continue to do so as we transition to a new press secretary over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Thank you for the opportunity." Then it was the president's turn. "First of all, I thank Scott for his service to our country. I don't know whether or not the press corps realizes this, but his is a challenging assignment dealing with you all on a regular basis, and I thought he handled his assignment with class, integrity. He really represents the best of his family, our state, and our country. It's going to be hard to replace Scott, but nevertheless, he's made the decision, and I accept it. One of these days, he and I are going to be rocking on chairs in Texas, talking about the good old days and his time as the press secretary. And I can assure you, I will feel the same way then that I feel now, that I can say to Scott, job well done." The announcement went fine, but when the president talked about us sitting in rocking chairs, I glanced at him and thought to myself, "I'm not that old, sir." I remember looking at some of the reporters' faces, the ones I'd come to know so well. They were there doing their jobs, covering yet another story in the endless round of White House news. But I also saw expressions of sympathy on a number of faces. We had developed a good relationship despite all the contentiousness and sparring during a controversial period. But they were human beings too, and it felt nice to see the look of human concern and fellow feeling on their faces. So this is what the end of the road feels like. The goodbyes, the going away parties, the kind letters and words had come and gone. 3 weeks earlier, I had announced my resignation. Now it was just me, carrying one last box of belongings, walking down the stairs to the ground floor toward West Executive Avenue, which I would drive down one last time that pleasant spring afternoon. There was only one other person present, Woody, the veteran officer of the Secret Service's Uniform Division, looking as professional as ever in his white uniform, sitting at his station, guarding the area just inside the staff entrance to the West Wing, where cabinet members are often filmed by news crews as they get out of their cars for a meeting. Woody was more to me than someone who protected the president and those of us on his team. I'd come to know him as a friend. As he turned and noticed me walking toward him, Woody rose to stand behind the arched desk. At that moment, my duties now finished, I could feel my emotions starting to get the better of me for the first time that day. It had been quite a roller coaster ride, with more twists, turns, ups and downs than any of us could have imagined back on January 20th, 2001. We had just returned earlier that day from my final trip with the president, an overnight one to Florida. "Goodbye, Woody," I said as I shook his hand and looked him in the eye. "Thank you for everything. It has been an honor." "The pleasure has been mine," Woody said. "You're a good man, Scott. Best of luck to you." "Thanks, Woody," I replied. "Take care." "You too, Scott." I would have preferred to chat a little longer, but my voice was starting to crack and my eyes were tearing up, so I turned my head and continued out the door. I didn't want to lose it in front of Woody, a good man who represented the many career men and women who keep the White House running and secure. We staff members come and go, but they remain, providing a sense of continuity and familiarity, reminding us that the White House belongs not to any president or party, but to all the people. As I got in my car, I took a deep breath. With my sunglasses in place and the tears now contained, I drove through the checkpoints, waving one final time to Woody's colleagues in the uniform division. I don't know if it was just the way they are or if the brownies Jill used to bake them made a difference, but the officers were always courteous, professional, and kind to me. It had been more than 5 years since I'd first driven into the White House complex, past those smiling, ever-vigilant faces. It had been nearly 3 years since the officer at the checkpoint to West Executive Avenue had leaned toward me and said, "You're Matrix now, you know that?" Matrix was the code name the Secret Service used for the White House press secretary. "I know," I'd said with a smile. Now I was Matrix for the very last time. The moment was emotional for me, since I had invested so much of my time at the White House. But the moment was also calmly surreal. I had an acute awareness of everything around me as I took a final look around, slowly driving through the grounds. As I exited the first checkpoint, the officer waved goodbye. At the next, I saw the officer extend a wave back to me, as if to say, "Take care of yourself," much as I'd just waved to him. Then it was past the final checkpoint, where I waved to the officer with the bomb-sniffing dog and one manning the guard post before turning to exit the White House grounds one final time. I was headed home to be with my wife, Jill, and to plan for our future together. But after more than 5 years of living inside the bubble of a presidency once filled with so much promise, and now woefully off course, little seemed completely clear to me. I was still wondering what happened. Not quite a year later, in early 2007, I would follow the Scooter Libby trial in Washington, D.C., curious to learn more about the truth. While we are never likely to know all the facts of the Valerie Plame leak episode, much had been revealed by the time Libby's trial ended. No one was able to learn more about the truth of the Valerie Plame episode than Special Counsel Patrick J. Fitzgerald and his team. They had access to all the documents and records that were available. They interviewed many people. They questioned many under oath before a grand jury. They had all the pieces of the puzzle that could be uncovered. Some of those that are still unknown are locked away by law, unlikely to be made public. Other pieces will likely never be made public by individuals like Cheney, Libby, and Rove, who have no reason to reveal them. But Fitzgerald is a highly respected, straight-shooting prosecutor. He presented the facts at the Libby trial in a straightforward manner. The case he set forth was compelling to the jury and outside observers. As a result, Libby was convicted on 4 felony counts for perjury and obstruction. The judge fined Libby $250,000 and sentenced him to 30 months in federal prison. Unfortunately, there's no way the trial could answer all the questions that Americans have been wondering about. In the next few pages, I'll give my tentative conclusions for what they're worth.